Hello and welcome to Beat Seeker. I'm Matt McButter.
And I'm Mike Wider.
Beat Seeker is a podcast that explores the changing world of music technology and discovery. In this episode, we discuss the rise and fall of the album format with Jeff Brightup. Jeff is the lyricist half of the award-winning Brightup Brothers songwriting team, the co-author of two books on pop music in the 70s, and vice president for media and communications at Manhattan School of Music.
With streaming now accounting for well over 80% of music consumption, most consumers are not buying physical albums anymore. Beyond that, they're not consuming digital albums either. More and more, consumers are listening to singles and playlists, bypassing the album altogether. We sit down with Jeff to discuss the origins of the album and whether it will survive the modern digital era. So Jeff, welcome to Beat Seeker.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Jeff, you've authored several books on the 70s, and you know, this was a very important time for the rise of the album, sometimes called the Golden Era. We want to get your thoughts on the history of the album and whether it's going to survive the digital age. But before we get into that, I think it'd be good for listeners to know a little bit more about your career. You've been an author, you've been a lyricist, you've been a music reviewer, communications exec, the list goes on. Can you summarize a little bit for listeners your background in the music industry?
I've had a sort of a multi-pronged career. As you mentioned, I wrote a couple of books, co-authored two books about pop music in the 70s with my brother Don, who's also my songwriting partner. We wrote those back in the 90s, early aughts. Precious and Few is the first book. It's about the early 70s top 40 scene. And then Night Moves is the late 70s top 40 scene. And we really isolated top 40 and looked at sort of the whole arc of the story of pop hits through the 70s. And I was a music reviewer at the National Post around that time in Canada. I was based in New York doing that, and an arts writer generally. I've produced music concerts here in New York. I'm currently the communications vice president of communications at Manhattan School of Music, a conservatory here in Manhattan. And as you mentioned, I'm a songwriter as well. My brother and I are a songwriting team. I'm the lyricist half. He writes the music, kind of like Ira and George Gershwin, we like to think. I'm the Ira in that equation. And the songwriting has sort of really sort of centered in New York City and Toronto. We've done shows in New York and Toronto, and as songwriters, we invite singers to interpret the music for us. We do sing occasionally, but generally it's been a vehicle for other singers to interpret our stuff. It's been a really great adventure that started about 10 or 15 years ago.
Very, very cool. I mean, all over the industry. And so what we,
all over the industry.
Yes. And so, you know, I think you're so well qualified to take us back a little bit, you know, sort of historically, from its beginnings in the 60s, maybe through the golden age of the 70s. The first LP was actually released in 1948, but it wasn't really until the 60s that it started to take off and ushered in what's often referred to as the album era. Before that, singles on 45 were more popular, and then something sort of led to the rise of the album as a popular format and the most popular format. What factors do you think led to the rise of the album?
Well, like most trends, it didn't happen overnight. A lot of people think of 1967 and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band as the first sort of concept album that really established the long playing format as a piece of art in and of itself, where tracks were sequenced to form an arc and tell, in some cases, even tell a story. Sgt. Pepper was a loosely told story about a fake band, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. But the truth is that the first real sort of concept LPs were, I think, were at Capitol Records in the 50s with Sinatra, working with Nelson Riddle, Songs for Swingin' Lovers, In the Wee Small Hours, records like that that had a sound throughout their 10 or 12 tracks. And I think that, you know, that gets overlooked because the rock era really established the album format. But I think Sinatra and Nelson Riddle had a lot to do with sort of orienting the album as a piece of art.
And so that's interesting, going back, you know, right to the 50s. And then as we get into the 70s, maybe the golden age of the LP, you know, post Sgt. Pepper's and some of those early concept albums. And this is an area that, you know, you've written extensively about, as you mentioned in Precious and Few and Night Moves. What do you think categorized the 70s as the golden era?
Well, you know, I think the essential unit of sale for pop music was the 45 for so long. That even despite the Beatles and you know, the Rolling Stones and the records that were coming out of the 60s, the hit single remained, in commercial terms, the major unit of sale into the early 70s. And then somewhere around the mid 70s, FM radio got a real foothold. So I always like to simplify it as AM radio, when it predominated, it was really all about hit singles. And then as FM radio sort of kicked in and took over in the mid to late 70s, it became about albums. And in fact, FM radio in the late 70s came up with a format that was officially called AOR, or Album Oriented Rock. So it was almost like they were saying, this is a change. This is, we're focusing on albums. So that, you know, Chum FM in Toronto would play deep cuts. They'd play track three on side two, not just the hit singles. Or I remember they would do album previews in prime time. They'd say, we have the new Steely Dan album and we're going to premiere it tonight in its entirety at 8 p.m. And it was an event. So this sort of idea of the album as more than just 8 songs of filler that surrounded two hit singles, because I think that's what a lot of, especially back in the rock and roll era of the 50s and early 60s, albums were being put out, but the record labels had two hits in mind and the rest was just, could be filler.
So cool. I mean, it's interesting, especially now that we're, you know, it seems to be going back in the other direction, back to singles, which we'll get to later.
So, Jeff, if you fast forward now past the 70s into the 80s and 90s, we changed format. You know, we introduced cassettes, we got CDs, but essentially we're still all buying albums. That was all that you could do. And it wasn't until, I think, 2001 that consumers really had an option to buy individual tracks again, a la carte, when iTunes launched. And then from there, you know, we had streaming and it just continued on. And it seems like there's been a continuous movement towards buying individual tracks or listening to playlists. Do you think that's what consumers actually wanted, but the industry wasn't giving it to them? And, you know, how can you sort of explain that the rise of the return to the single in some ways, you know, with the advent of digital and streaming?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know that this podcast is in, you know, the overarching theme is how do we find the music that we want to hear now? That there's algorithms, there's different ways of tracking things down. But back in the music industry heyday, rock era heyday, we were having our music chosen for us by record labels and radio. So record labels would be this prime source because they would be signing artists. And artists really needed record labels back in the day because, you know, we didn't have the means of production. We needed the studio time. We needed the equipment, we being the artists, to record. So record labels had a lot of power in determining who gets heard. And then radio was the secondary sort of extension of that, because radio would choose what songs that they played, and that then came to us, the consumers. So, and you know, it's easy to be cynical about the record, the music industrial complex of that time, because, you know, they treated their artists badly and notoriously you know, rip them off with bad contracts, especially in the early days. But the truth is, they weren't a bad delivery system. When I look back on the music I was listening to in the 70s, you know, artists like Joni Mitchell and James Taylor and Randy Newman and Earth, Wind and Fire and Stevie Wonder and Steely Dan, I'm not sure that there were a bunch of artists in the background who weren't getting signed, who were at that level. I think that they were pretty good curators of what I was hearing in retrospect. And for the most part, radio fell in line and played what they were given. That got subverted, as you said, when streaming happened. The CD went along and it was still the album format. And when streaming happened, Napster sort of, you know, undermined the music industry by allowing people to get music for free. And the industry wasn't ready for that. I think they'd had their head in the sand about it. And music has been essentially more or less free ever since. You know, as much as artists get paid for Spotify streams, it's such a small, small amount that it can't be a meaningful career. You can't make a living with Spotify streams. At least most people can, unless you're sort of a mega, mega Beyonce, Taylor Swift kind of artist. But moving to songs, it's really interesting because, yes, even my music listening, and I'm a real album person, my music listening is now frequently determined by just a bunch of songs on a Spotify playlist that I press shuffle and I enjoy what comes up. But it's so I agree that we've moved to a place where the song is the sort of essential mover, the prime mover of music listening. But the album won't die. Like I was thinking about it the other night because the Grammys were on, I think on Sunday. An album of the year. Album of the year. It's almost like the best picture at the Oscars. Album of the year is still a big deal. And so Taylor Swift won with Folklore, I think. And that was big news. I don't know. What do you guys make of that?
I think artists, maybe artists like, you know, it's a nice delivery system for them as well. Rather than just thinking of individual tracks, it's a way for them to group their creative output into a broader envelope. I think that might be part of it. It's not just on the listening side, but also on the production side.
I think you're right, Matt, and it is a way for an artist to say something bigger than they can in one individual track, to sort of have a chunk of music together that forms that arc. I think there's also still, we need to remember that there's a lot built up around albums, in that you release an album and then you do a lot of marketing promotion around that. You might tour on that album. So the industry is still geared heavily around the album being the delivery vehicle, but it does seem to be continually being chipped away at year after year. So for example, I think it used to be that you would release a single a month or two before your album dropped, and then you'd release the album and there might be another single on that was promoted. Now, you know, with modern albums, we're seeing there could be 4, 5, 6, even more singles that are coming out, where you've almost got half the album released before the album drops. And what I'm wondering about is whether this is the sort of slippery slope of the artist sort of relenting to maybe this consumer choice, but also that if you think about the algorithms that are driving modern listening, you know, things like Release Radar, for example, on Spotify, it pops in new songs released by an artist in the last, say, 2 weeks. And so I think a lot of artists are recognizing that if they want to keep top of mind in streaming, on the algorithms, on social media, that the economics is more, as you say, Jeff, more geared around monopolizing time of the listener rather than just selling how many albums I can. And so you've got these counter forces, I think, working against what may be the purest artistic delivery vehicle, but economically and with modern technology, it's sort of challenging this format. And what I'm wondering about is, can it survive?
I love that point. I know that artists have been sort of, even artists who package their music in album form still, which I guess is most artists, have taken to doing single releases and in fact advancing their album with sort of three song dumps to sort of build interest in the eventual album. I'm not sure that that works particularly well to attract interest in the eventual album. It may get the songs out there. But I think by the time the album's released, if you've over the course of 6 months dumped the songs gradually, then who cares about the album once it comes out? I think that's been a commercial idea that I'm not sure has done that well. There's probably a lot of examples that would counter that, but I'm thinking of John Mayer did that recently with his most recent album. And I don't think it worked particularly well. Matt, going back to your comment, I love your point about how it's a way of packaging their creative output. I think that the album still gives artists a way of thinking about how to organize their output. So in some senses, I'm not sure that will ever go away necessarily. But you know, it's interesting, like you were talking about the sort of the idea of releasing singles and releasing individual songs gradually. And it's funny because I was thinking the other day when I was thinking about this conversation we were going to have, I thought about the Beatles and how even as they were sort of carving out new ground for the album, they were under pressure, even given the output of like an album every 8 months back then, they were under pressure by the record label to be releasing singles between albums. So mine the albums for singles, but then before the next one comes out, we need individual singles. And they released double-sided singles, We Can Work It Out and Day Tripper, Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane on one single, and Hey Jude was a single as well. Those songs, those like iconic Beatles songs, weren't on proper album releases. They were 45s before they were eventually released as part of a collection or various collections.
We'll be back in a moment after this brief commercial break. Our episode today is brought to you by Boombox. Boombox is a game where you play in music leagues with your friends and face off in friendly song selection competitions. Mike, we just finished round three and you crushed it this week. That category was a song with a solid horn section. Break it down for us.
Yeah, so this was a fun category. It's not an easy one, but I figured that I was going to find an interesting song in the funk category. And I really like funk, but I actually don't listen to it that much. So one of the cool things about this game is that it forces you to dig into genres that you might not always listen to every day. I found this song called Sweet Sister Funk by Ramon Morris, and it turned out to be the number one voted song of the week. So I was pretty happy about that.
Nice
and so
work.
I'm still not in first place, but inching up there in second place now. If you all want to know a little bit more about Boombox, you can find out more information at boomboxsoftware.com.
And we're back.
You know, is it possible as well that if you think about how we used to consume music, we'd go to the record store, we'd buy the album, we'd listen to the whole thing because I just paid for the whole thing, right? And we might favor different songs, but you have a limited number of records or albums or CDs in your collection to listen to. Whereas now we have access to 40, 50, 60 million, you know, songs on Spotify to choose from. And so with that infinite choice, maybe there's a gravitation to be cherry picking the top songs from every artist versus spending the time on the deep cuts because we're distracted with all this choice.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think that like anything, when there's a huge amount of choice, it can be daunting. Shelley, my wife, recently said we were talking about our listening and what we'd want to listen to. And she said that she missed being able, even though we're in a small Manhattan apartment and we don't really have room for physical product, she said she missed seeing the spines of the CDs on a series of shelves. So you could say, oh, there's that CD I haven't listened to for a while. I'm going to put that in, as opposed to Spotify, which is this endless choice. And where's that CD? Oh my God, I almost forgot that artist existed because I don't see them anymore.
Yeah. You know? I hear you big time. I find the same thing because now they're just files on a computer, and that is your window into it. They're not these, you know, tangible objects.
Now, Matt, you were giving an example of your daughter who bought a K-pop CD and doesn't actually have a CD player. Can you explain that?
Yeah, she collects. She's really into K-pop, Korean pop, and she now collects K-pop CDs, but she only listens to the songs on Spotify. Like, she's only creating playlists, and she listens to entire albums, knows every song on the album, because K-pop is a genre that's still very album centric, and they're, you know, they're very rabid fan base, which is, you know, becoming huge with the rise of bands like BTS and Blackpink that are starting to, you know, get huge popularity in the US as well. But the album is still really dominant in that genre, and they're collector's items. So she's buying it not because it's not just like the old CDs we used to buy. They're each one is basically it looks like it has the extras that a box set would have. So it's like a 50-page full color booklet of photographs that's exclusive that you can only get. So they have something to look at. Extensive liner notes, bios on the band members. And then here's the big thing, collectible cards, just like hockey cards or something.
I was literally about to say, it sounds like she's buying it the way you would buy a hockey card.
Yeah, and it has that kind of value there because you don't know what ones you're going to get. And so people will sometimes even buy more than one copy of a CD because they want to get collect the full set, even though you might get this, you know, have some overlaps or some doubles, as we used to call them in hockey card parlance. Yeah.
Got 'em, need 'em,
yeah,
need 'em,
got 'ems.
Yeah. That's actually brilliant. Mm-hmm. That's diabolically clever.
Yeah. And it's an interesting model for other genres to follow as the labels and the music industry is looking for ways to keep the album relevant and to keep album sales up.
Yeah. Not sure I should name the band because this is sort of something that came to me off the record, but one major band from the 70s who's still out there touring and is still putting out new music very occasionally was told by the record label that they had that why don't we just put out digital product? Why should we even produce CDs for this? And they said that a lot of their income is stage sales at shows of actual hard copy CDs. So they were aghast. Can't just do digital. Our audience still buys. But that's at the other end of the spectrum. That's at the older audience who were raised on buying LPs, who still want to have the product. Those people are still out there. So it's really interesting to sort of see that, you know, your daughter's generation are collecting product, hard product, for a whole different reason. That's totally fascinating. The other thing is, because vinyl is kind of making a small comeback, I think it's a little overstated, the comeback of vinyl, but there are collectors or music listeners out there who want that full round sound that vinyl gives and that are actually going back to buying vinyl. The irony is, when CDs first came out, CDs were quite expensive. They were $20 a pop or whatever, and vinyl had sort of come down to $7. Now vinyl is really high priced. Because
they're very expensive. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've paid like 30 plus bucks for an album.
Oh, so are you in, Mike, on buying vinyl now?
Yeah. So we have an interesting setup, and, we have a cottage, and all we have just listened to records there. So we try and go full analog. And then elsewhere, we are similar to you on Spotify, random playlists. But it does create a different experience. There's the sound aspect of it, but then also you've got the physical thing that you're sifting through and saying, what do I want to put on? And also listening to an entire album is, now that you've been trained out of that and we've been listening to these random songs on playlists, it is a different listening experience, I think.
Yeah, I would agree to that. I find it hard to let go of the idea of a sequenced arc built around an album as an artistic unit or product. I don't know that I'll ever let go of that because it's in the DNA, so to speak. But I do, interestingly, like this sort of, as someone who is producing music with, you know, with my brother as a songwriter, I'm of two minds about Spotify. Obviously, artists aren't being compensated well enough in the streaming world. But as a music consumer, it's so convenient. And I used to sort of justify it in my mind that, well, really all I'm doing is listening to stuff on Spotify that I already own. So I've paid in and this, but that of course has expanded now and the whole Spotify universe is available to me. So, I'm reaching beyond what's actually burned onto my hardware or that I've actually paid to download on iTunes. And so there's a guilt aspect to me listening to Spotify. I feel guilty about it. But it's so damn convenient. And one of the things I've tried to do to sort of get around the idea of not being able to see my music collection is I'll literally go through iTunes and look at artists that I've almost forgotten about. And I'll go into Spotify and I'll create a playlist of their music so that it's there when I look in my library on Spotify so I can actually see them.
Yeah, I think that is a helpful way towards retraining you to, because it's just so easy to hit that shuffle button and then you walk away and it just continues. That I think we're lazy, right? And it's been a more convenient way to buy things. And I feel that guilt as well. I feel the same way sometimes when I'm shopping on Amazon, where I feel like, oh my God, I've just ordered this very small thing, and it's so easy because it shows up the next day. But I think that laziness as consumers is hard to fight.
No doubt. No, I'm with you on the Amazon thing.
So Jeff, we like to ask all of our guests a little bit about what they're listening to and how they find new music. So maybe we'll ask you for an album tip. And in the 70s, if someone wants to get off of the playlist and get back to listening to some golden era 70s album, can you give listeners a recommendation?
Oh, I love that. Yeah, do I get two?
Sure.
Okay. I would recommend Earth, Wind and Fire's All in All. I think it's 1977, right when they were hitting their peak. And they combined incredible melody, sort of pop music, straight up melodic genius with an unbelievable imagination for how to groove. So in the midst of disco, which had kind of flattened out the groove, so every disco song had the same kind of straight ahead kind of hi-hat groove. Earth, Wind & Fire was absorbing funk. They were absorbing Beatles-esque pop. They were absorbing R&B, soul, disco, everything. And they had a 9 or 10 piece band, full horn section. And they kind of took that in and spit it out as this, beyond brilliant amalgam of every style that I was into. And it still sounds fresh. I listened to something from All in All the other day. It still sounds, if you crank it up and you listen to it, the groove is fresh. Every song has their own groove, its own groove. The arrangements are detailed and harmonically complex, and yet it's commercial pop music. So they were a great album band, but they were also a great singles band. I would check out Earth, Wind & Fire. And, you know, I, as a bright up, I would be probably expelled from the family if I didn't recommend a Steely Dan record. So I think one of the high points of album-oriented rock in the late 70s was Asia by Steely Dan. Had a couple of serious hits on it, Peg and Josie, but it was a seven-song suite of near perfection. And they borrowed, where Earth, Wind & Fire was borrowing from funk and R&B, Steely Dan did have those influences, but they were leaning heavily on jazz form and, you know, making choices that really hewed to the harmonics of jazz. But again, they were a catchy pop band. So they were deceivingly complex. They could hit AM radio, and you knew what you were listening to was pleasing. You didn't know exactly why necessarily and how they did it, but they had one foot in the sort of complex harmonic world of jazz and one foot in AM radio. You know, it's funny because we talked about Chum FM back in the day in prime time doing album previews. I remember actually the album preview for Asia, and it was later at night. I think it was probably 11 o'clock, and I was in my room in Mississauga listening to the clock radio. I tuned to Chum FM at 11 o'clock, listening to their preview of the new Steely Dan album, Asia. And Don was down the hall, my older brother, listening to his clock radio, the album preview of Asia. And I remember after the first track, Black Cow, I remember hearing this muffled, woo, from next door. Like Don was so hepped up that he was actually screaming in his room. But I would go to Asia. I think you can't go wrong with Asia and all in all.
Those are two great picks. I feel like we could do a podcast on Jeff album picks.
and it is, you know, it is a bit of sadness that masterpieces like that seem to be waning, seem to be a thing of the past.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that as the album gets eroded, that's bound to be one of the side effects. But you know, it, your thing about delivery systems and songs, the whole sort of beat seekers premise, finding music, I find it interesting that specifically in Canada, I'm thinking of two sort of pop icons in Canada right now, Justin Bieber and Shawn Mendes. The fact that both of them started on effectively on social media, that, you know, Bieber was in Stratford, Ontario, covering Justin Timberlake and some of his heroes and dropping those covers on YouTube. And that broke him. And then the music industry swooped in and absorbed him and turned him into a music industry kind of icon. And then Shawn Mendes was covering Bieber on Vine. And that he exploded that way. And then he just happened to have songwriting chops. So the music industry absorbed him and he had something to give back and he took off. But there's almost like this cannibalism of, I'll cover you on social media and boom, boom, boom. Those are rare examples. The fact that they're both Canadian is just sort of an interesting side note.
Yeah, those are great examples. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for your time today. If people want to know more about your work, what's the best way to find for them to look you up?
Well, the Bright Up Brothers are on all the various streaming and iTunes and Amazon and Spotify. So if you want to hear our music, I would go to look for Just Passing Through, the name of our most recent CD.
That's awesome. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, and Precious and Few and Night Moves, the books are available on Amazon as Kindle books. And I think you can still order the hard copy, although I don't think they're printing any more hard books.
Well, thanks, Jeff. Really appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us today. It was a great conversation. Really, really interesting.
It's been great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Jeff. You've been listening to Beat Seeker with your hosts, Matt McButter and Mike Wider. If you like what you've been hearing, please like, subscribe, and share this podcast. If you really like it and want more, you'll find bonus content and exclusives on our Patreon. Visit beatseeker.fm. That's BEAT seeker.fm. and on social media at BeatSeekerPod. And giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts helps too. This program was recorded at the Devil Lake Studios and the Tunnel Under Arundel. The program is produced by Matt McButter, Mike Wider, and Kate McCartney. Thanks for tuning in, and keep seeking.